From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
I wouldn't have said, yes, I'm only going to write for young people when I first started, but my whole life sort of pointed me that way, right? I had been teaching. I liked children's books. I liked reading. I really, really enjoy the company of young people. I was a mom. Like, there were all these experiences that were pointing me in that way. So when I finally sat down to write, that's what emerged. This alchemy of family story and culture and young people.
That was author and Library of Congress's 2023-24 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Meg Medina, the first Latina to serve as ambassador in the program's history. During her two-year term, Meg Medina looks to engage readers across the country to embrace the joy of reading and to encourage connection among families, classrooms, libraries, and communities by talking about books that both reflect the reader's lived experiences and those that open them up to new perspectives. This diversity of perspective is something Meg has been advocating her entire writing life. Herself a Cuban American, Meg's protagonists are strong, if flawed, Latina girls. Her books examine how culture and identity intersect through the eyes of young people, even as they explore problems familiar to any kid navigating home and school. For example, her award-winning YA novel, Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass, looks at bullying, while Burn Baby Burn takes place in New York City in 1977, the summer serial killer Son of Sam terrorized the city. Her middle grade novel, the 2019 Newbery Medal awardee, Mercy Suarez Changes Gears, is the first of three books in a trilogy about the Suarez family and the illness of a beloved grandparent. While her recent award-winning book, Evelyn Del Rey Is Moving Away, examines change in the life of a young child. Whatever the target age, Meg's books are alive with vibrant characters and have a laser-like focus on authenticity and truth. I spoke with Meg Medina shortly after she was named National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and I began by asking her what she thought we should know about her.
Well, let's see. I am a writer who writes picture book, middle grade, and young adult fiction. I float pretty easily from one age group to the other. My background is Cuban American. My parents arrived in this country in the early 60s and the rest of my family throughout the 60s and 70s. But I grew up here. I was born here. So I was the first North American born in my family, which was a strange position to be in. I was sort of the translator general for the family, not only literally, you know, translating English and forms and things like that, but just culturally, what this country was and how things were here and what was okay in childhood here. What were the books? What were the styles? All the things. What were the normal activities of an American kid? And so I feel like that experience of growing up in an immigrant household where, you know, money was tight, when language was both a joy and an expansion, right? Like being able to speak Spanish and English, but also an obstacle sometimes. All of those experiences, I think I'm going to be able to bring with me into the ambassadorship for the better. We have so many different kinds of people in this country and so many languages spoken. It'll be helpful to be able to connect with them.
Where were you raised?
I was born in Alexandria, but I wasn't raised there, interestingly. Just before my birth, my parents' marriage dissolved. And so my mother found herself in this country with no relatives. You know, everybody was still back in Cuba. But she did have a cousin, Nena Fernandez, who lived in Queens, New York. And Nena got on the Greyhound bus and came to Alexandria. She taught my mother this concept called the garage sale. This American concept. They sold everything that wasn't nailed down. And then my mom brought us to New York, the biggest city in the world, right? And when I think back on what that must have been for her, but she raised us. She raised my sister and me in New York in the 60s and 70s, which was a hot time in New York City. And that must have really been, I think, bewildering for her. Then I spent some time in Massachusetts. I lived in Florida for 10 years where my own three children were born. And interestingly, because life is funny that way, through job transfers and so on of my husband, we ended up back in Virginia. And today I live in Richmond.
Well, New York City is certainly a multicultural hub with a large Latino population.
Yeah, and certainly in Queens. Queens is, I think, the most diverse county in the U.S., for sure one of the top most diverse places. When I was growing up in Flushing, Queens, it was a really interesting mix of people. There were the older sort of European immigrants from Greece, from Italy, Ireland, that group. But there was a big group of Cubans who had just arrived, Colombians, Indian families were growing. And of course, it was the beginning of the establishment of the Asian population in Flushing, which is now heavily Korean. So it was everybody. It was a wonderful way, I think, to grow up. It offered the daily experience of living and learning with people who are like you in lots of ways, have families and jobs and concerns and all of those things, and also really different. I'm really grateful for that experience.
Yeah, I grew up in New York too. And when I think back now, just in my building, how many first generation people were in that building from literally all over the world. And to me, it was just natural, like breathing out and breathing in. But now I look back and I realize how lucky I was.
Yeah, I think so too. It was just a natural way to learn how to be and share space with people and be respectful and learn from each other, you know, and love each other and see each other as part of a community.
Where was reading in your life when you were young?
You know, it was in lots of places. Interestingly, so there were not a lot of Latino characters, obviously, in the books that I was reading in the 60s and 70s, or at least not in the books that were being introduced to me. I was being given the books that many kids in the early 70s were being given, the Judy Blume, you know, Witch of Blackbird Pond, My Side of the Mountain, all of those sorts of old classics. I read all of those, and I enjoyed them. I liked reading. Mostly, I liked story. And so I didn't need to have the character look exactly like me to enjoy the escape that reading provided me. My family, though, were real storytellers, just naturally. They I think, processed their trauma through story. So they processed like they're leaving their country and their family. I was filled with stories of what Cuba looked like and who their neighbors had been and the time that so-and-so did this. And, you know, it was just constant storytelling in the family. And for all kinds of purposes, sometimes, you know, to advise me in life. I knew a person who did this once and look what happened to them and I'd get this whole story. They used story in lots of different ways. So I think I just sort of naturally developed an ear for that kind of drama and the interest in how people behave. And I find that in my work all the time. You know, when I'm writing, I'm really fascinated, not exactly by like the events of the novel, but by how the characters respond to those events. And so I just feel like that I could trace right to storytelling. And then in terms of reading, you know, my mother did the best that she could. I mean, she had been a teacher in Cuba, so she knew the value of having knowledge. My mother was wise enough to get me a library card, to get us the encyclopedia, to let us buy books through the troll book form, those little order forms that used to come through school, even though money was really, really tight. I think she really liked to see us figuring out language, being able to read in English, being able to know things that mattered to her.
Well, you taught for 10 years before you turned to writing. So
I did.
I mean, was it a vocation for you, sort of inspired by your mother? How did you come to teaching?
That's really funny. I came to teaching kicking and screaming. Okay, here's the true story of how Meg Medina became a teacher. I did not want to be a teacher because my mother wanted me to be a teacher. My mother wanted me to either be a teacher or inexplicably a translator at the UN. I don't know why she thought that could be possible, but okay. Or the other thing she also often mentioned was the phone company. The phone company was a good place. And my mother really wanted me to have health benefits and she wanted me to have security and she didn't want me to worry as she did here as a factory worker, about those kinds of concerns, like how you were going to feed yourself and house yourself. And those seemed like really practical jobs. So I graduated college and I went to work at Simon & Schuster, where I was the worst editorial assistant probably ever. I was not good at it. You know, then as now, life in Manhattan is expensive, and having a wardrobe for those kinds of jobs and getting yourself there, all of that cost money. And I was from another, what was then especially another universe in the boroughs, right, in Queens. I just was not suited to that job. And I decided to leave it because, believe it or not, I could make more money as a public school teacher. And New York City was having a teaching shortage. So all you had to do was promise to take 15 credits, and then they'd give you control over the fate of 36 poor little kids in your class, right? So they sent me to PS19, which is the largest elementary school in Queens, or it was at the time. And my students came mostly from the Dominican Republic, very recently arrived, some like within days. The beginning was pretty rough, I gotta say, right? Because they have a teacher who does not know things like what is a lesson plan and other basics that are important. But here's what happened in very short order. This job that I took just sort of as a placeholder while I really figured out what I quote unquote really wanted to do, it just took me because the kids were adorable. And I felt really connected to their families. Like their experiences were very familiar to me, their neighborhood, all of it. And I just fell in love with them, with children's literature. And what I most remember about that year is the last day of school when I sat at my desk and I just cried because I was going to miss them. And I was worried that their next year's teacher wouldn't maybe love them or respect them in the way that I felt that I did, or I don't know. I just was so attached to them. And then I just stayed teaching. I got very curious. I went to the Louis Armstrong School, and then I taught at an arts magnet school in Florida. And I just became enamored with literature and writing and children's books and young people of every age. They kept me laughing. They were maddening sometimes. Especially the teenagers later, they were asking really hard, bold questions. And I loved all of that, very unexpectedly.
You made the next transition, and you were 40 when you decided to make the leap and begin to write.
Yeah.
What motivated that?
So I had been teaching writing for a long time, but I wasn't doing much of it myself. In other words, I was teaching other people how to give voice to the things they were curious about, but I was not completely fulfilled in teaching. I loved it. I loved my students, but there was something still missing. And the missing thing was that I really wanted to be writing. So I started small. I started writing, you know, at little newspapers, and I wrote, I can't tell you how many articles for like $50 an article. It was just ridiculous starvation wages. But I built up my clips. I built up a thick skin to be able to edit. Like when an editor says, yeah, the lead is terrible, you got to rewrite it 10 minutes. You can't get darling about your words then, right? You have to be able to separate and do the thing, right? So
yeah.
I started that way. But mostly when I turned to children's writing, it was more dramatic. I had moved to Virginia with Javier, and we had three kids, and I was in a new city. And my friendships were largely with the mothers and fathers of my children's friends. And I was living in a suburb, and there were very few Latinos. And I felt disconnected from the arts community, and I felt just lonely. I felt really spectacularly lonely. And so at 40, I had knew someone through a board that we sat on, who said to me one day, have you ever thought of like thinking of a vision statement for yourself? Like, what do you want your life to look like as a writer and an artist, if this is what you say that you're missing? And so I did it. I came home. I felt ridiculous, I have to say. It felt ridiculous, but I did it, wrote it, And I kept that piece of paper. The first thing is that I got very weepy when I finished reading it because I thought, this is ridiculous. Who am I to wish these things? This is just silly. It felt like I was writing fantasy. What's interesting is I wrote that document in like 2003, maybe. I don't remember the exact year, but it was in the early 2000s. And almost everything that I wrote came true. I don't know how to explain it, but I share that story with writers a lot because sometimes putting it down, like getting it out of your imagination and putting it down on a piece of paper, like it's a tangible thing that you can look at, helps raise your sights. It helps you sometimes be more accountable. Like, this is what I want. So what's one thing I could do today to move me closer to that? And that's how I just started moving in that way. And one thing led to the other. And here I am. It's not like you write the wildest wish and it comes true. It's not like a genie in a bottle, but taking yourself seriously
can focus the mind.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So I think it's an important exercise to do with writers, with kids. What is it that you want?
And was it always books for young people?
That's hard to say. I wouldn't have said, yes, I'm only going to write for young people when I first started. But my whole life sort of pointed me that way, right? I had been teaching. I liked children's books. I liked reading. I really, really enjoy the company of young people. I was a mom. Like, there were all these experiences that were pointing me in that way. So when I finally sat down to write, that's what emerged. This alchemy of family story and culture and young people. It ended up being like a clave, which is that the rhythm, you know, in Cuban music, that 3-2 rhythm or 2-3 rhythm that is sort of the underpinning of Cuban music, that just never changes in a composition, right? No matter what you put on it. And I feel like that ended up being my clave. Growing up and culture and family.
Well, your books are very, very different, from picture books to middle grade to YA, and they're different characters encountering different challenges and different joys. But there are commonalities, and you mentioned family is certainly one of them. What are some of the others?
Oh, I think girls finding their voice, for sure. I think love, especially within families, because when we talk about family, you know, the very same people who love us so very much sometimes really hurt us. And looking at that little sliver feels important to me. I think I am willing to walk into grief and hard things with children and bring them through the experience, like honestly and safely, whether that's the death of someone, whether it's a violent family secret, whether it's bullying, those really hard, dark spaces that kids go through growing up. I like to feel that they don't have to do it completely alone. They can sort of experience it, practice it, read about it, think about it with one of my books as their companion.
You know, while the experiences your characters encounter are culturally very, very specific, they are familiar to first-generation kids from anywhere. You know, as you mentioned, translating not just English, but habits, culture, technology to parents, and sending money back home. This is first generation. That's what happens.
Yeah, for sure. That's one of the joys. I love that. I love when that happens. I love when someone who has nothing to do with me, like I had a young woman in Wisconsin. She came to me and she said, "Oh my gosh, Yaki Delgado wants to kick your ass. That's my story." This was not your story, is what I was thinking about. Like, this is so different. This is Queens, Latina girl, you know. But for her, this issue of being bullied, of being targeted, being alienated at school, all of that really resonated with her. And certainly that has happened with Burn Baby Burn and with others. It's really rewarding being able to be both specific and universal at the same time. And that comes, I think, truly from just being very honest to the experience. And that's the experience I have when I read other people's books outside of my own cultural experience. I'm drinking in all that they are opening up to me, drinking in the culture, the language, the customs, all of it, And I'm also feeling connected and seen in those moments where those events, those people, an attitude that a character has resonates with someone I know or something I've seen. And that, I think, is at the heart of why children's literature can be so powerful, especially when we create really robust, inclusive collections in classroom libraries and school libraries and in neighborhood public libraries, because it knits us together. It allows us to do both things, to celebrate all that we are and all the cultures that make us up as a country, and who we are as people, like just as human beings, the commonalities. And I think that is really vital, especially now.
Well, it's kind of the alchemy of literature, that strange alchemy that happens when the more specific you are, somehow the more universal it becomes.
Mm-hmm, for sure. I believe that's true. And making sure that the cultural details are exactly right. There's something about that that is deeply respectful and necessary in literature, especially literature for children. We want to make sure that the books that we're offering them are accurate so that they have true understanding of who their neighbors are, who they are themselves. You know, just getting it right really matters. And I think, just as you say, the specific and the universal is flip side of the same coin.
How do you start any book? Do you start with an idea, with a character?
Usually the character and the age, that frames the concern. So if I'm going to write a story, you know, a kid's in the hospital, right? It's a very different experience if you're 6 versus if you're 17, right? And so the age really helps frame the voice for me. And that's the first thing I'm really looking for, the character's voice, their personality, what they sound like, and what their initial problem is. And when I say initial, it's not just the first thing that comes up, but like the problem this character is willing to tell me at first when I just know them minimally. It's like going to a dinner party with people, right? You get, oh, hi, this is so-and-so. They, you know, they do this for a living. And like, you're knowing these very superficial things, they're important details, but they're not really the story of that person. As I write the book, as I'm exploring this so-called problem, right, that they have, usually they crack open and we get to the deeper issue. Somewhere, I don't know, around page 50 or 60, I have a much deeper idea of what the character is really up against. And then we start mining for sure. So I always start that way. Although I say that, and I'm working on a fantasy right now, and I'm just finishing up the manuscript, and I started with setting on that one. Which I've never really done. I started with a sense of place and who is in that place, and then I pulled the character from there. But the place was very, very important. It takes place in the abyss, in the ocean.
Wow. I wonder how much you look at your own background, your own girlhood when you write, if not for the experiences themselves, but for the kind of questions you were asking yourself.
Oh, gosh, 100% of the time. Really. People ask why you write for children. And the truth is, you're actually not, right? You're writing for who you were at a particular age. I know that sounds so narcissistic, but that's what actually ends up happening, at least in my process. When I'm writing someone 15, 16, I inhabit who I was at that age. And the things that hurt me at that age and the outrage I felt at different things at that age and all of it. I try to become that person again. And to do that, I have to go back through memory. I have to unpack things that in some cases I don't want to think about at all and really think about them and lay them bare and decide like what part of that still resonates now. Why have I remembered it for 30 years, for 40 years, you know, whatever, and come to some revelation that I can provide, you know, with the character in the story. So I feel like with Yaqui Delgado, for sure, you know, I was bullied in exactly the way that you see in chapter one. It happened to me a little earlier in junior high school, but that was essentially what happened. Burn Baby Burn. I was 14 the summer that Son of Sam was murdering girls in Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx, and so on, all the boroughs. You don't live through that without remembering that. And certainly I knew family troubles and depression and things like that in the house, which are also themes in Burn Baby Burn. All of it. I pull from my life shamelessly, and I use my books not only to create entertainment and artful pieces, but really to unpack and understand all that has happened.
It's interesting because when I read young people's literature, my emotions are much more on the surface. Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty engaged reader in general, but with young people's literature, I laugh more, I cry more. I know at a certain point I found myself saying, oh, Mercy, don't do that. Just don't do that.
Me too. I do the same thing because I don't plot these books, right? I write them very intuitively. So I sit down and I just follow Mercy through the story. Like, I have vague ideas of what might happen just because, you know, the age and the setup, but generally I'm very surprised. And I can't tell you how many times I said that to Mercy, like, oh, come on, you can do better. Come on, Mercy, tell the truth, step up. You know, I had all kinds of motherly advice, but that's the thing. The mother, the writer, that person has to step away. When you really give yourself to writing a book for kids and you're writing it this way, where the character is sort of leading you, you have to leave all of the adult concerns far away. They'll have a place, but it's not in the drafting of the book.
Well, let's talk about Mercy Suarez and the wonderful Suarez family. How did the Mercy Suarez series come to be?
I started that as a short story. It's in an anthology called Flying Lessons and Other Stories. Ellen O from We Need Diverse Books invited me into that anthology. It was 10 authors from different backgrounds. And we needed to just write a story that featured a character who was from a traditionally marginalized background. And so I said, sure, I'm going to write a Latina character. But so what, right? I was thinking, you know, after you say yes and you sign the contract, it's like, okay, but she doesn't sit around just thinking about her Latinidad, right? Like, what is the thing? And so I wanted to look at this notion of what parents are willing to do for their kids to move them ahead. And sometimes they have to swallow some really bitter pills, right? So in the story, Soul Painting Inc., Mercy is about to start school at this private school where her genius brother is also attending. And her father has traded his painting skills. He's going to paint the school gym in exchange for some tuition breaks. And it was a look at what it's like to be a scholarship kid, but more what it's like to be invisible. One of these careers that people think of as invisible, yard workers, painters, like they call you the paint guy, the yard guy, like you're nameless. And her father is that. And yet she's going to be a student at this fancy school. And the push and pull of that, the shame, the pride, the fury, all of the feelings that go into that, into finding yourself, being asked to be grateful for this wonderful opportunity, right, that is being given to you, and also frustrated and, you know, having lots of feelings about what it's like to move in those circles. So I wrote the story, I loved the story, and then the book did really well. It's in a lot of school libraries, and I just couldn't stop thinking about Mercy. And both the editor, Phoebe Ye, who edited that anthology, and my editor at Candlewick said the same thing. Mercy's just too big for a story. I think you want to write a novel for her, and I did. And that was Mercy Suarez Changes Gears, and that was her in the sixth grade, and then I kept thinking of the metamorphosis that happens from sixth to eighth grade, and I said, I'll just keep going. Sixth grade, seventh grade, and eighth grade, and then it gives me a chance to really have her deal completely with her grandfather and middle school and all the things that are bananas about middle school.
It is the most wonderful series. I read the first book when it came out, and I was just so entranced and jumped on each one as soon as they came out. So thank you for doing it.
You're welcome. I'm proud of that series. And I'm glad that I'm leaving it behind. It was hard to say goodbye to the Suarez family because I want to be adopted by them. But I feel like I told the whole story, and I don't know. I hope kids continue to find the Suarezes in the years to come.
I'm sure they will. Now you're the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. So tell me about your ideas for this role.
Wow. Yeah. It's big. So my idea is that I want to rescue reading from this sort of notion as something that belongs only to schools, that we test, you know, like just think about how we talk about reading to kids. If you don't read by this age, you know, this is going to happen, or that's going to happen. Your ears will fall off. You will, you know, like all these really dire warnings that may in fact be true if we're looking at the data and so on. But it's the reading joy that seems to come last. And I really want to rescue reading and reconnect kids to reading in a different way and thinking about reading and talking about reading in a different way. So they ask you to design a framework for how you're going to move throughout your 2 years. And my framework is called Cuéntame, Let's Talk Books. So Cuéntame is this phrase that Spanish speakers use, like when we don't see each other for a while and it's like, hey, what's up? We say, cuéntame, what's up? You know, like, tell me what's going on. And so mine is cuéntame, let's talk books. And when I visit schools, they'll have a chance to ask me questions about my work and all of that. Mostly, I'll be modeling for them. I'll be book talking for them. The books that I am reading and loving and want to shout about. So when we talk about books that we love to somebody else, we're not only talking about the book, right? We're also talking about ourselves. We're sharing what excites us, what we love, what we think is interesting. And so that, I think, is where connection is. Like if I come to you and say, oh my gosh, Joe, you've got to read this book because, and I, you know, I'm super excited. I'm sharing myself with you in a very important way. So I'll be book talking to them, and I'm hoping that they're going to book talk to me the books that they're reading. I'm already getting suggestions in the mail from kids. I've been given lots of suggestions for manga and graphic novels, which I'm devouring as quickly as I can. Another part of my platform of Cuéntame is connecting families with the public library, especially now. I am a huge library fan and a huge fan of librarians, and they're just not the shushing places of yesteryear. They are vibrant places that have something for everybody in the family. And so creating a push for library cards and highlighting really great programs that are going on at different libraries. I'm really just encouraging kids to think of the library as a place to go to gather books, to make it part of their life. And then the last part I'm really interested in is just creating an audio archive at the Library of Congress of new authors creating work now. I think what happens sometimes is we rely on the voices and the names that we've known or that our parents read when they were little, like the, you know, the biggies, and they're great and they endure for a reason. But my feeling is that we're in the golden age of children's literature. There are just so many incredible authors coming to the table and writing from all sorts of experiences. And so I want to have a place where the kids can just come and click and hear the author read us what they think is their best minute or two of writing, tell us why they think that's such a great minute or two, and also share with us something they believe is true about children and reading. I think when we hear an author's voice, when we hear their work in their voice, it's thrilling. So those are right now the three main prongs of Cuéntame. Now, as every good teacher will tell you, you plan, you put it into effect, and then you just sort of see, you know, what's sticking, what's working, and you make adjustments. So I think that as the ambassadorship moves forward, there'll be adjustments. But right now, that's what I'm cooking.
As you look ahead to the next 2 years, what is it right now that you're most looking forward to?
What am I most looking forward to? I think I am most looking forward to connecting with kids being able to spend 2 years really going into schools that have applied to have me come, who've collaborated with their public library, who've given like deep, deep thought to our time together. And then being there in community with that whole school community, their moms and dads, their teachers, their school librarians, their neighborhood librarians, like helping them knit themselves together around books and being part of that. That to me feels really, really exciting.
And that is a good place to leave it. Meg Medina, thank you and congratulations. And I'm thrilled.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate the time.
That's author and the Library of Congress's 2023-24 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Meg Medina. She's the author of many books, including the Mercy Suarez trilogy and the award-winning picture book, Evelyn Del Rey is Moving Away. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd love to know your thoughts. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Then leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.